We have four members to this panel. We have Dr. R. Rodney Howell, who's president of the American College of Medical Genetics Foundation and chair, and he's also chair of Secretary Leavitt's Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders and Genetic Diseases in Newborns and Children. We have Dr. William A. Gall, who's clinical director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health, with his colleague, Dr. Suzanne Hart. And finally, we also have Dr. Andrea Gropman, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Neurology at George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, attending in neurology, who's also with the Children's National Medical Center. Welcome. Who's going to start? Dr. Howell, are you going to start?
I think that's the order.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Astru. It's my pleasure to be here. And I'm going to start with some very general overview comments about newborn screening. The newborn screening has been an active program in the United States for a little over 40 years. It started with the recognition that a long-known condition, that is phenylketonuria, an abnormality in the metabolism of phenylalanine, could be dramatically improved if infants very early in life were put on a special diet that was deficient in phenylalanine. The infants who were treated early were recognized because they had a family history of the condition so that they could be tested when they were little babies and so forth and tried on the diet. It was also shown very early that if you tried this new diet on older children with phenylketonuria, the benefit was minimum. You had the very striking paradigm, a dramatic diet that had to be diagnosed in the newborn period. And since there's no family history usually in these conditions, you needed to conceive of a test that could be applied to the population at large. At that time, the question was posed to Bob Guthrie, who was a professor of pediatrics and microbiology in Buffalo, who was active in the community of persons with handicaps, about could he devise a test. And he came up with a very simple bacteriologic assay that depended on using a dried blood spot on filter paper and putting those dried blood spots onto agar containing a B. subtilis spore that was dependent on phenylalanine. And this very simple test turned out to be extremely usable in the public health arena, and largely because of public advocacy of families with children with phenylketonuria. This technology was adopted rapidly throughout the country over a period of several years, and this was in the early to mid-60s. The situation stayed relatively the same technologically, that is, a dried blood spot, you punch out one hole and you test for one condition. However, other conditions were added that had therapies, such as maple syrup urine disease, hypothyroidism, but you had this one spot, one test technology. Some states actually ran as many as 10 tests, all on individual little holes that they punched out of this test. The scene changed quite dramatically in the early 90s with the widespread adoption of tandem mass spectroscopy. And this technology is extremely reliable and permits you on a single dried blood spot to analyze for a number of abnormal compounds, and in the areas of inherited rare metabolic disease, it turns out that you can readily diagnose around 40 conditions in a matter of minutes with considerable accuracy. And since that time, there's been a considerable increase in the number of tests that are done in newborn infants in this country. At the current time, the national recommendations from both the advisory committee that I chair and also from the American College of Medical Genetics is that there are 29 conditions that are appropriate for newborn screening in the so-called core panel. These conditions all share the common denominators. One, they're all very serious. They all have treatments that, if begun early, are beneficial. And the other thing is they're not evident at birth. In other words, the baby looks normal, so there's no sign that would say, goodness, this baby has this problem. Now, state newborn screening programs are in all instances operated by the states. And so what is screened in Virginia is decided in Virginia, et cetera. But it's been very interesting to me from a national level to look at what's happened since these recommendations have gone down in the past few years. Because as we sit here today, 90% of all the babies born in the United States are getting that core panel done. And so the states have actually quite rapidly adopted that panel. It'd be appropriate to comment at this time is that there are 4.1 million babies born each year in the United States. And since they are all getting genetic testing and many, or most of them, as many as 30 conditions, newborn screening for genetic diseases is by far the most common use of genetic testing that's done today in this country. I think these conditions are particularly interesting for a variety of reasons. One is that people with these conditions are born with what I would call a permanent abnormality or disability. In other words, they lack a protein or they lack an enzyme. However, if detected very early, they can commonly lead an essentially normal life. And the recent NIH panel on the treatment of phenylketonuria had a college student as a member of the panel who herself had PKU. And untreated PKU, the average intelligence is under 25. So the benefits are enormous. There are many programs currently being screened for in the country that are not, shall I say, curative. For example, most states currently screen for cystic fibrosis. And although the outcomes are improved, children with cystic fibrosis persist with disability, as you know, although they do much better if diagnosed early, et cetera. The other widespread screened condition today that falls in a similar category is all states are either implementing or currently screen for hearing defects. And although you can benefit these children by early identification of the defect, they commonly will need either cochlear implantation or assistive devices in order to hear. So they will need long-term support and help. And I'd like to just comment about the fact that there are dramatic new technologies on the scene. I've talked about tandem mass spec and so forth. But currently under investigation are some microfluidics, which use extraordinarily small samples and can screen for a large number of areas. There are new diseases that are being screened for that have therapies coming up. Two lysosomal storage diseases that are currently in pilot studies in the United States for newborn screening are Krabbe disease, a historically rapidly fatal disease that, if identified in early infancy and treated with a bone marrow transplant, has dramatic improvement. These children are not cured. They still have disability, but they're dramatically improved, and they survive. The other is Pompe disease, a lysosomal storage disease that in its most severe form causes early infant death, is under treatment with enzyme replacement therapy, which is being introduced for a number of conditions, as the commissioner certainly knows, having been seminally involved in this area himself in the past. I think that the point is that the technology that's being used in newborn screening is highly accurate. One commonly talks about, you have a certain number of false positives. And I would say that the term false positive is not the right term, because false positive suggests that you have an error in laboratory diagnosis or you have something. But we have physiologic variants with chemical changes in the baby. And so a test may not be within your normal limit and when repeated is normal. But I would call those, we need to come up with a better term, there's variation and so forth. But the technology that's being used is extremely reliable and very accurate. And I think one of the major things that's come out of the newborn screening needs in recent years has been the fact that once we identify an infant, and about 1 in 1,000 babies born in this country will screen positive for one of these conditions. So it's a substantial number of infants, although they're individually rare when you put them together, it's a substantial number. We need to develop a system to put all of those into a long-term follow-up program to see exactly how they're doing with treatment, what's happening to them, and also make available these children and young adults for new therapies and new technology. And this is one of the areas where the National Institutes of Health is looking very carefully at how to implement a program that would study all the babies that are born positive in this country. Those are my opening remarks. Thank you very much.
As is become traditional today, we're going to hold off our questions until the end, and then because we figure there'll be overlap in response.
Okay, thank you. Well, medical technology can bring us to a diagnosis and can often bring us objectivity to that diagnosis, and sometimes the diagnosis can bring us a prognosis as well. So Dr. Hart is going to talk about some specifics of those medical technologies, and then I'm going to offer a perspective after she speaks for just a few moments. And Dr. Hart has wide experience in molecular and biochemical diagnostics, so she's going to tell us a few things about those specifics.
The Task Force on Genetic Testing, convened by the National Institutes of Health, Department of Energy Joint Working Group on the Ethical, Legal, and Social Implications of Human Genetic Research, defined a genetic test as the analysis of human DNA, RNA, chromosomes, proteins, and certain metabolites in order to detect heritable disease-related genotypes, mutations, phenotypes, or karyotypes for clinical purposes. Such purposes include predicting risk of disease, identifying carriers, establishing prenatal and clinical diagnosis or prognosis. Prenatal, newborn, and carrier screening, as well as testing in high-risk families, are included. Tests for metabolites are covered only when they are undertaken with high probability that an excess or deficiency of the metabolite indicates the presence of heritable mutations in single genes. Tests conducted purely for research are excluded from the definition, as are tests for somatic, as opposed to heritable, mutations and testing for forensic purposes. Individuals who undergo genetic testing fall into two main categories. One, symptomatic individuals, or those in whom a specific clinical feature or phenotype suggests a genetic disorder, or two, individuals with a family history of a genetic condition. Current genetic testing methodologies are broadly categorized into biochemical, molecular, and cytogenetic techniques. This testimony will focus on biochemical and molecular techniques. Existing molecular genetic testing includes targeted mutation analysis, for example, by targeted sequencing, allele-specific oligonucleotide analysis, etc., whole gene sequencing, typically covering coding regions in exon-intron splice junctions, determination of number of repeats for trinucleotide repeat disorders, deletion duplication analysis, and determination of epigenetic changes such as methylation status. Detection rates vary based upon the gene and the methodology used. As sequencing costs have fallen, full sequencing has become more common. This will likely result in higher detection rates compared to targeted analysis. In the future, array technology will be more frequently employed in the molecular diagnostic laboratory. There are two main areas where this technology will be helpful. First, for large genes, array technology provides a cost-effective and time-saving platform for mutation detection. For example, the dystrophin gene, which is mutated in the two allelic disorders Duchenne muscular dystrophy, DMD, and Becker muscular dystrophy, spans more than 2 million base pairs of DNA. More than 500 deletions, 80 duplications, and almost 1,000 single base changes have been described in this gene. Two arrays have been developed to aid in genetic testing for these muscular dystrophies. The first array detects deletions and duplications of the DMD gene, which account for approximately 70 to 75% of mutations in DMD and 90 to 95% of mutations in Becker muscular dystrophy. The second array is a sequencing array that allows the whole DMD gene to be interrogated in a single assay. Another use of array technology will be the evaluation of multiple genes simultaneously. The advantage of this technology can be illustrated with X-linked mental retardation. Currently, 63 genes on the X chromosome are known to be associated with syndromic X-linked mental retardation. This is mental retardation associated with other phenotypic features. An array is under development that would allow analysis of 34 genes on the X chromosome concurrently. At the present time, such analysis would have to be conducted sequentially at a significantly higher cost and turnaround time. Biochemical testing for rare diseases involves standard blood chemistry, hematological and immunological studies, as well as specialized tests for rare metabolic disorders. These include amino acid and organic acid analysis, enzyme assays, antibody tests, specific small molecule assays, and profiles of abnormal metabolites. As Dr. Howell has mentioned, tandem mass spectrometry is revolutionizing newborn screening, and this method has the potential to improve the biochemical diagnosis of symptomatic patients as well as newborns. The technique can allow faster and perhaps more definitive diagnosis of known diseases and can reveal new disorders by detecting small molecules that signal disease. Ultimately, the best testing methodology varies with the disorder or gene involved and may also depend upon ethnicity. For example, carrier testing for Tay-Sachs disease in the absence of family history is best performed by molecular means for Ashkenazi Jewish individuals, but by biochemical methods for non-Ashkenazi Jewish individuals. In some cases, combined testing may be the most appropriate approach.
So I would say that these medical technologies get us to a diagnosis, and sometimes that diagnosis is incredibly meaningful in itself. That is to say that everyone who has the diagnosis will have a disability. And examples of that could be progeria, which is a premature aging syndrome in which the patients die at about 13 years of age, or a Fragile X, or Tay-Sachs disease, which is a lysosomal storage disorder, or other lysosomal storage disorders, adrenoleukodystrophy, for example, or Usher's syndrome, which will predict deafness, or albinism, which will predict blindness. But then there are other disorders in which the diagnosis does not itself predict disability, and you need to know something else about it. For example, in Huntington's disease, you know eventually there's going to be problems, but you may not, if you carry the gene, you may not have a problem at age 15. And the same goes for some of the late onset myopathies like hereditary inclusion body myopathy and even Fabry disease, which is later onset to these disorders. Lists of these types of disorders, the ones that by themselves are going to give a problem immediately and the ones that may later, can be constructed with some reasonable objectivity because of medical technology and expertise. And that's the second point that I'll come to in a little bit. But most patients who come with a rare disease diagnosis will eventually require medical assistance. The issue is, at what time is the diagnosis being made? What time are they being evaluated? If they come to medical diagnosis and use medical technology at the time when they have symptoms, they probably already need intervention. But sometimes the genetic diagnosis is made before that, and it's only later that they'll need to be declared disabled and receive assistance. Furthermore, there are different rates of progression of these disorders, and some of the disorders are even static. Well, I think that the new technologies that will come about will not change this basic paradigm incredibly much. In other words, the diagnosis will always take us so far, but never so that we can completely predict for all of these rare diseases that disability is required. The bulk of the decisions regarding these allowances also require input from healthcare professionals, experts in the field. And fortunately for many of the rare diseases, there's for the metabolic disorders, there's a Society for Inherited Metabolic Disorders. And that society has those experts. And I think that as a group, the SIMD would be willing to offer its expertise in the adjudicatory process, along with other healthcare professionals. So they could do this on an individual label basis, but they could also offer advice a priori by creating some of those lists of the disorders which are certain to require disability allowance, and those that may or may not, based upon particular symptoms. Thank you.
First, I'd like to say it's my pleasure to be here today, and I commend the Commissioner and his committee for convening this hearing. As you've heard from my colleagues, our knowledge of inborn errors in metabolism and our screening in recent years has expanded at an impressive rate as a result of research in laboratories and clinical trials around the world. Rapid diagnosis and, when possible in treatable conditions, metabolic rescue is mandatory to improve neurologic outcome, as the majority of these conditions that were discussed impair the neuroaxis in some way. In addition, advances in technology have made early diagnosis feasible, and with this recognition, the outcomes of treatment better. As new treatments are emerging, they will impact on outcomes. One consequence that you've heard of early screening and treatment is that children with these diseases that were once considered uniformly fatal are now surviving into adulthood, some as healthy, productive citizens, others with significant challenges ahead of them. Despite these advances, however, there continue to be barriers that exist leading to diagnosis and provision of services to individuals with these conditions. Many of these conditions are expected to worsen over time, and although physical disability may be expected, the impact on neurologic function, cognitive changes, and mental function may be less clear. Likewise, the discovery of new variants of previously described metabolic diseases has added further to the complexity of diagnosis of inherited metabolic disorders. Late onset and adult variants of diseases formerly thought to occur only in infancy or childhood are being diagnosed not infrequently, and often the clinical features of the disease in older individuals is markedly different from that seen in infancy. As a child neurologist and geneticist, I have firsthand experience in the problems of getting to diagnosis and being able to determine disability. Neuroimaging of inborn errors in metabolism has begun to paralyze advances in other technologies. As the central nervous system effects of some congenital and acquired infections are recognized by characteristic distributions of abnormalities on neuroimaging studies, likewise, specific imaging findings may in some cases strongly suggest a metabolic disorder or inborn error of metabolism as the etiology of the patient's neurologic symptoms or disability. In fact, large collaborative research studies, predominantly in adult degenerative disorders, have convened to look for biomarkers that may actually predict the onset, severity, as well as response to treatment in a number of conditions which could impact the determination for disability. While in other cases, the imaging features of metabolic disorders may mimic that due to other causes, there are certain well-described imaging patterns that strongly support the diagnosis of a metabolic disorder. These patterns, in turn, may depend upon the age and stage of the disease at the onset of symptoms, and furthermore, cell type and regional selective vulnerability to metabolic toxins and ischemia are responsible for the differing imaging patterns that are seen. The differential diagnosis of a metabolic disorder is thus narrow, depending on whether the findings affect primarily the gray or white matter, both, and there is typically an imaging signature that may be recognized, such as an altered signal in the basal ganglia in glutaric aciduria type 1, the parietal-occipital changes seen in Milas and other mitochondrial disorders, absence of the creatine peak on magnetic resonance imaging spectroscopy seen in creatine deficiency disorders, or an increase in N-acetyl aspartate, a putative neuronal marker which is seen in Canavan's disease. Likewise, a common imaging finding in patients with changes in mental status may be that of edema caused by vasogenic or cell swelling and may accompany stroke, infection, or metabolic disorder. The location of the swelling, for example, being in white matter, brainstem, and cerebellum, would invoke the diagnosis of maple syrup urine disease, for example, and not hypoxic ischemic injury in an infant presenting with changes in mental status and edema. Certain organic acidemias, such as propionic or methylmalonic, have a predilection for causing signal changes on MRI in white matter and basal ganglia, and the urea cycles classically show elevations of glutamine as can be measured non-invasively by magnetic resonance spectroscopy. Because inborn errors in metabolism can present in the neonatal period with neurologic distress, metabolic acidosis, and multisystem involvement, similar to features encountered in hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, an underlying metabolic disorder may be undiagnosed unless the clinician maintains a high index of suspicion and performs appropriate diagnostic testing. This certainly will impact the ability to recognize and provide needed services for these individuals. So as I've indicated, magnetic resonance imaging has emerged as a powerful tool in the study of both normal and abnormal brain structure, function, and biochemistry. It is a non-ionizing and non-invasive technique, and most, if not all, medical centers have access to one or several scanners, and imaging of pediatric patients, including our premature infants, is now quite routine. While skillful assessment of the results is required, there are several references to assist with this process. MRI can allow the differentiation of cell bodies or gray matter from the connecting fibers or the axons, which appear in the white matter. And with a technique called magnetic resonance spectroscopy, or MRS, brain biochemistry can be sampled in a non-invasive way, and this information taken with the clinical features to aid with diagnosis. In addition, newer modalities of imaging are moving from the research scanners into more widespread clinical use. For example, white matter microstructure can be studied using a technique called diffusion tensor imaging, which may allow abnormal white matter to be visualized prior to seeing it on conventional MRI. And magnetic resonance spectroscopy to study brain metabolism can allow for delineation of regional metabolic changes as a result of disease progression or as therapeutic interventions are introduced, can be used to measure outcome. Neuroimaging studies may be indicated in the majority of patients with mental retardation, developmental delay, acute encephalopathy, loss of skills, or cognitive impairments of unknown etiology. Even in conditions that are due to known causes, the MRI can be used to assess the degree of involvement, which may help contribute to disability determination. The most common imaging techniques used currently in the diagnostic evaluation of individuals with mental retardation or disabilities are CAT scan, MRI, and magnetic resonance spectroscopy. However, given the unique gray-white matter differentiation, MRI is probably the best imaging test in a diagnostic workup. Some conditions in which neuroimaging procedures, and specifically MRI, have proven to be useful include the following cases, which I'll discuss: neuronal migration disorders, brain malformations or hypoplasias, intrauterine infections, disorders due to birth injury, vascular disorders, white matter diseases, including demyelinating disorders such as ALD, multiple sclerosis, metachromatic leukodystrophy, and Canavan disease, and other metabolic conditions, organic acidemias, mitochondrial disorders, urea cycle disorders. Because of the huge array of available molecular and biochemical tests, the information from neuroimaging may help focus the search. The technologies of today that are useful within the MRI scan package itself include FLIR imaging to view white matter, MR spectroscopy, and diffusion tensor imaging. And in the future, improvements of these methods with higher field scanners and other types of metabolic imaging will certainly improve early diagnosis. Therefore, the delivery of SSI and SSA services to individuals with rare disorders will depend upon early diagnosis, understanding of the disorders and their effects on function and independent living, and understanding the limitations may not be static, but in some conditions are expected to be progressive over time. The major challenge and question, therefore, is to how to use and integrate these technologies in a way that will impact disability determination with the goal to establish an accurate and valid system that benefits those patients in need of services. I believe I speak also on behalf of my colleagues that as a group, neurologists and geneticists are available to engage in such dialogue to address this, as we appreciate the importance and complexity of this disability determination process. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I've got a couple questions. We, of course, because of our mission, have to ask very different questions than what doctors trying to treat disease or companies trying to provide therapies ask. So we're very focused on trying to figure out how markers correlate with functionality. So I wanted to ask first on genetic testing. A lot of lysosomal storage diseases, for instance, have a wide range of severity. Pompe disease, you can have children dead at the age of two, but I've also had the experience of talking to a woman in her 30s and for 15 minutes before she disclosed she had Pompe disease, and I had no clue. So that there's a range, and something like Hunter's at somewhere 5-6, it'll split pretty evenly between those kids that have a pretty good shot at not only survival but living pretty normal lives with some of the new therapies, and those where the disease attacks the central nervous system and they're looking at a horrible death, you know, in a 5 to 8 year period. To what extent are we able now, through genetic testing, to sort out within those diseases that have a range of severity? Can we tell genetically at birth what the likely course is, for instance, with a Hunter's child, which one is likely to have the CNS complications or not? Or is that we're just not there yet in terms of being able to use these data?
I'm going to let Andre answer in a minute, but I don't think we're really there yet with respect to genetic testing. It turns out that there's relatively poor, or let's say incomplete, genotype-phenotype correlations for most of these disorders. And that may fill out over the next, let's say, decade or two, because the clinical characteristics are then associated with certain mutations. But there's a problem here, maybe not quite so much for Hunter's as for some of the others that are autosomal recessive. You have compound heterozygotes. So in other words, two different mutations. And you can't really tell. You can tell that there's a severity associated with one mutation, but not so well when they're two different mutations associated, you know, so that's an issue. Turns out that some of our best phenotype correlations are with biochemical measurements. So the amount of residual enzyme activity does correlate pretty well with the severity of disorders. And that goes way back. So we should perhaps move ourselves a little bit away from the molecular and towards the biochemical, which essentially measures all sins. You know, it's the final measure of how much residual competency you have for that enzyme pathway. I'd also say that differential tissue expression can be a problem here. In other words, you might have a particular mutation in a gene such that there is a reasonably normal amount of enzyme activity within the liver or the kidney or some such, but not so much in the brain, and that can account for some of the differences too. And we're not very good at that because we don't get those organ or tissues to measure the enzyme in.
What percentage of diseases, is it just a question of brute force as opposed to sort of an intellectual issue that needs to be resolved? Do you have any sense of that?
What percentage of diseases what?
Would we be able to perhaps sort out the severity of the disease from gene testing as opposed to waiting to see what happens? Is it possible, do you think, in 5%, 10% if we do the work? Is it higher than that?
I think it's higher than that, actually. It has to do with accrual of patients and performing a clinical characterization at the same time as doing the molecular diagnostics. So to a certain extent, this is a matter of time and money. You could probably do it now for half or more of the disorders. It's just that, you know, there aren't grants for that. There's no real support for that. Companies are coming close on occasion to doing that because it's sort of in their best interest.
Let me comment. I certainly agree with everything Bill said, and I mentioned the fact that the NIH is very interested in following up on the newborn kids, and one of the things that will be looked at keenly is looking at all the markers, looking at enzyme activity, and correlating that with long-term follow-up to see how that works out. Now, the other thing is that New York State has had to deal with this in spades in their screening program for Krabbe disease. They have mandated screening in the state for Krabbe disease, and like Pompe disease, there's different forms of Krabbe. Some are acutely ill as infants, and others have a later onset. And so what they've done, and I think they've worked very hard on this, is to, once the patient is identified as having an enzyme deficiency, they basically then have a whole variety of other tests that they put into place, such as nerve conduction velocities, a variety of other things, and try to make a judgment about, you know, what's going to be the time frame of that patient. And I think those will clearly be informative when they finish their studies over this time. But they've had to deal with, and Pompe, of course, is a perfect example. Bill mentioned the professional groups are looking at paradigms in the diagnosis and treatment, and the college has been working with the SIMD on a paradigm in the diagnostic follow-up of patients that are with Pompe disease. Because once you get a patient with Pompe disease, you're going to have to make some decisions fairly early, because some of the patients will have massive cardiomegaly and others will be asymptomatic. And I think doing genotype analyses will be helpful, but the correlations have not been very good. But enzyme activity, according to the Duke group, has been fairly predictive.
Okay. I've got one more question, then I'll turn it over to my colleagues. I'll start with Dr. Grotman, but I don't want to stop anyone else from jumping in. And this is a little bit out of our mandate today, but that's okay. You're all here, so I'm just going to ask what I want. So, we have a lot of claimants in certain categories in the neurological diseases, and it can often be very hard for us to sort out for these degenerative diseases sort of the break point where they fit the standards that Congress has told us that we have to apply. And so one of the things we first started to talk to NIH about was multiple sclerosis and looking at whether we could look at a measure like neuronal scarring in the brain and correlate that with functionality. And one of the things that came back at some point was, well, the brain as a whole, that might be difficult because depending on where the scarring is, that might make a big difference in terms of functionality. Do you have any advice to us if we're I mean, one of the things that would be a blessing for us and for claimants if we could sort it out would be some efficient ways to handle these types of neurological diseases. Do you think that we're likely to find certain areas of the brain if we focused on sort of subsets, not the brain as a whole, and could track damage like neuronal scarring and MS? Are there certain areas of the brain that perhaps we ought to be more focused on and we're more likely to be able to prove some sort of correlation to functionality?
I think it's more complex than that, and basically,
I was afraid of that.
Yeah, unfortunately, it has to be on a case-by-case basis, because with some of these metabolic conditions, I didn't mention that in addition to the enzyme defect, there may be other compounding factors, such as a patient may have seizures, for example, which adds further disability. The cortex being affected will impair cognitive function, but that's not to say that having a lesion in the brainstem, which affects basic functions such as swallowing and the like, isn't significant as well. So, and you know, certainly a cerebellar lesion can affect the ability to walk, without falling. So I think, it will have to be a case-by-case basis. I believe that we do have limitations with imaging. We certainly have a number of impaired children who have at least structurally normal MRI scans. So we know that there's more to be told than just, the brain looks fine, but obviously it's not functioning well. We're not able to image on the level of synapses, for example, in kids with autism. We're not there yet. So I think it's more complex than that. You may, for each disease group, may be able to categorize disabilities. But I think just taken in general, it's much more complex than that.
A couple of questions. I guess first, how many inherited metabolic disorders would fall under the umbrella of the SIMD group that would look at those diseases? Do we have any approximate numbers?
Boy, you can help me out on this, but probably in the range of 100 or so. Now, there are 225 or 250 members, they're 450 members of the society, but in terms of actual physicians taking care of patients, they're probably about 225 or so. And they overlap some, so I'd say maybe 100, 150 different diseases.
And so the society members that you have probably would have pretty good knowledge of most of these disorders, that they really could, you could bring them together without too much difficulty to address the issue of the level of functioning and...
Yes, I think the SIMD recognizes its service role to the community and to the country. And I think that they would be anxious to offer information on this and to assist in something that the Social Security Administration wants to establish. Basically, the physicians in the SIMD take care of these patients and deal with these issues all the time. They actually write letters for their patients to the Social Security Administration. So they're very interested in the care of the individuals with metabolic diseases. And there's a great lack of understanding on the parts of people all over the country concerning the severity and the functional effects of these rare disorders.
Sort of following up on a line of questioning that the commissioner started with, and also the last panel, they began the discussion or surfaced the idea that there are scales that researchers and physicians use to measure severity in many of these disease categories. That interests me a great deal, because one of the things we would like to do is begin to find more objective measures of the severity of and the disabling aspects of a disease. Can you comment on that or add anything to that discussion?
Yeah, I think there are some limitations with the scales, one being certainly many of them don't apply to pediatric neurologic patients. I'll take MS as an example. So MS in children can be very different than it is in adults, and those scales may not apply. Even just to take diagnostic scales, the criteria for NF1, which, you know, were ingrained in all of us going through medical school and training, really, you're hard-pressed to make a diagnosis in a child under, you know, puberty age using just, you know, the diagnostic criteria from the NF1 collaborative scales. So I think, and Child Neurology Society is keenly aware of the fact that we don't have scales to the level that our adult neurologic colleagues do, and are actively working on it. I know, you know, for cerebral palsy, there are scales. There's a book called, you know, Book of Scales, but whether they're all applicable, you know, is another issue. So I think, and the same would go for some of these metabolic conditions, because even children with the same metabolic disorder may present different manifestations. One child may be still ambulatory with predominantly cognitive effects, whereas another child with the same disorder may be in a wheelchair, for example. So,
if I could cut in, I don't want to discourage Dave, but I just want to ask a specific question on the line. For the childhood MS cases, are those always going to end up being severe cases as adults, or do you get cases where you have onset very early and it's very intermittent the way sometimes some of the adult cases are?
I think the story is just unraveling with childhood MS. You know, certainly making the definitive diagnosis of MS in a child versus its close cousin or acute demyelinating encephalomyelopathy is a problem. You know, a child who presents with one demyelinating event, you know, what is it about their event or them that will predict whether they have MS or they don't have MS? So I think that's unraveling now. There is a working group within Child Neurology Society addressing those issues.
I'd like to sort of interject, too, about the point about geneticists. We see patients who often have multisystemic disorders, so that there isn't really so much a scale with respect to one particular symptom. It's a question of whether, for example, a cystinosis patient has just renal disease or also has muscle disease, swallowing difficulties, pulmonary disease, or central nervous system problems, or diabetes, because those are complications. And they're fairly discrete as opposed to scaled. You know, they've got it as a complication or not. When I need functional scales, I generally get it from the rehabilitation medicine folks who are very good at this and measure function in terms of range of motion or abilities to do certain activities of daily living. And they're the best for me when I need a consultation.
I would like to ask the question that I've asked the earlier panels. Obviously, a very distinguished panel would be very helpful. Obviously, it's critical for us to have the relevant information about the individual's impairments and so on. Is there anything that we could be doing in terms of when we ask for information from medical sources to make it easiest for the medical sources to provide the information to us? If anyone has any comments on that?
I don't have any comments on
that. Are you sort of asking about freedom of information, or are you asking for specific information to be garnered?
Obviously, we're trying to make determinations whether or not the claimant's impairments meet a particular listed impairment in our listing of impairments, or we're trying to assess function. And some of the earlier questions have referenced that. So the question really is we have some difficulty sometimes having medical sources provide information to us about their patients, essentially. So what I'm looking for is there an easier way for medical sources to provide that information to us? Should we be asking the questions differently? Is there anything else we can do to facilitate that process?
I think Bill has made an important comment. Is it the spectrum of conditions we work with is such. For example, in Pompe disease, you need a cardiology evaluation, the cardiac problem, et cetera. Another, you have in some of the others, you may have a neurologic problem completely, you have a neuromuscular. So I think that a task force, shall we say, at one of the referral centers is, I think, the thing that's going to be helpful. And you're going to need all of that.
Not to jump on the panel to answer them, I think one of the things that's going to be important for us as we start listing these diseases is to flag for the examiners the type of tests they should be running, because they don't know, because they don't have familiarity with the disease. You know, they could see a description of Fabry disease and not realize that you should be looking at primarily probably at the heart and the kidney. And it will could be an awful lot more efficient for us if we have instructions to our examiners where, you know, that's sort of flagged out for them instead of trying to get them their general doc to find an expert who can give them that answer. And a lot of times we have a lot of difficulty getting expert consultants in the rare disease areas.
One of the things I think can be very helpful along that line are the practice guidelines that are being developed for virtually all of these conditions that basically will flag, you know, what are the systems that become involved. And they currently are in the process of being developed for many of these. They've been developed for Pompe and Fabry and Krabbe, but they're coming along for the others.
And who generally has the lead in those practices?
The American College of Medical Genetics. Again, a lot of overlap with SIMD because we have, I'm a former president of SIMD, but I currently am now with ACMG, so there's a lot of overlap between the groups, but they work together on that. It's usually published under the ACMG guideline.
But I do think that for a particular diagnosis, you could probably a priori get SIMD members who are experts in that to create a list for that particular disease for you to a request from the physician. And you could probably do it for many, many disorders, and not complete, but many. And that could serve as sort of the first measure or guide for what you need to make that assessment. And I think the SIMD and other experts would be willing to do that.
If I can sort of take another tack on the Judge Costato's question. Our examiners are looking, the treating physician is looking at the patient one way, and our examiners are looking at the patient another way. And we sometimes have a sense that we don't ask for the right material, or the physician doesn't send us the material we need to that there's a gap in terms of understanding or a mindset between the treating physician and the examiner. And if we could bridge that, we might get the right answers to our questions that would help us to make that disability determination. I think that's what we've been wrestling with. How do we get that?
Well, I could just sort of reiterate what I said about function. In other words, you're right. Physicians don't think about function very often. They're happy to make a diagnosis and give some medications, et cetera. But the physical therapy and the rehab folks do think about function all the time. So perhaps you could require that there be a rehab medicine type consultation on this, you know, what can the person do and what can't the person do attendant to this diagnosis? What would you think about that?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I think, you know, neurologists are focused somewhat on function, but certainly our rehab colleagues, that's the bane of their practice. And to say, okay, you know, thank you, we have the information about the diagnosis, we need to determine the functional limitations of this individual. I would think that perhaps some places would not necessarily have access to physical medicine. So basically laying out exactly what a functional determination is might be helpful in those cases.
Dave, do you have anything else? You want to make any final remarks?
I would just like to thank all the witnesses today, all the panel members, because the information is very helpful, and I think it's going to go a long way to helping us tackle this particular problem.
I know I've just checked with Steve and Frank. They don't have any final remarks except also to thank the panelists and everybody that's participated today. I just want to say this has been extraordinarily useful just to follow up and on everything that's been said today that's helpful. It's going to take a very, very long time. But I do want to remind people in the audience that from our vantage point, this is not a one-shot exercise, and that it's our intention to have these types of hearings on a quarterly basis on a different subject each time. And we have blocked out a schedule for the rest of the year and have the next three meetings set. And as we get into the summer, we'll have the next year meetings set, and by the time we've exhausted all the obvious things, it'll be time to go back and do updates on technologies on the other. So this is, from our vantage point, we're trying to fundamentally change how we access medical information. And this is, as you can see from today, there's so much that's out there. It's so hard, it's so complicated, that if we just try to do it in our own closed world, as wonderful and talented as our doctors are, we can't possibly do it all. And so we're trying to find more ways to reach out and get as much help from experts in the field as possible. I think this is a terrific way to start. I think all four of these panels were extremely helpful to us. And so I want to thank everybody who participated, Dave, Diane, and Glenn, and the staff that put together this terrific program. And thank you all, and I'll let you out 17 minutes early. So again, thank you all.